Hi, Steve Pomerantz here, host of On the Money with today's On the Money Extra, where we feature market updates and insights as well as guest interviews with noted financial experts to help you stay informed and learn the facts to make the right decisions about money. So let's get started. My guest is Greg McBride. He is Senior Vice President, Chief Financial Analyst for Bankrate.com. And they've just put out a survey trying to find out what kind of investments do people feel are the best investments. And so I've asked Greg McBride, who's a regular guest on the show, to join me. He's a Senior Vice President and Chief Financial Analyst for Bankrate.com to discuss this and other issues. Welcome back to the show, Greg.
Great to be with you, Steve. Thanks for having me.
So, you know, I've been questioning investors' attitudes towards stocks for many years, and now Bankrate has put some meat behind my questions. So what percentages of the people out there think that stocks are the best way to accumulate wealth?
It's a distant third. Only about 17% of Americans this year told us that that would be their preferred investment for money that they wouldn't need for more than 10 years. The top of the heap this year was real estate, which actually supplanted cash. Cash, which was a close second this year, had actually been the first choice the past couple of years.
Yeah.
So we're not seeing the same sort of bunker mentality to the same extent, but as you can see, Steve, people just aren't warming up to the stock market. And if anything, I have a little bit of a concern that maybe once again, people are starting to look at residential real estate as some form of golden ticket.
Yeah. Well, there still remains a hangover from the 2008-2009 crisis. So I can see that cash would be considered, you know, superior. Real estate is something that people are very familiar with. But stocks over time have absolutely been the best performing asset class that people can invest in, but they get so caught up in the volatility. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, the memories of 2008 are still very fresh for investors and for, you know, a lot of younger investors in particular, and millennials especially. It's not just the financial crisis of 2008. And in a lot of cases, they saw that was the second time they felt burned by stocks.
Yeah.
They got hit in the 2000 tech bust. So twice in the span of just several years, you know, a lot of people just wore off stocks at that point. And you know, I mentioned millennials. They actually have the lowest preference for stocks among any age group. And we're specifically asking about long-term money. And I got to tell you, Steve, that's the one that keeps me up at night, because when we talk about that generation of Americans, not only are we talking about the biggest cohort of Americans, we're also talking about a group that has the biggest retirement savings burden in history.
Right.
Yes, and because of their longer lifespans and higher healthcare costs.
Yeah.
And if they're not embracing some market risk, short-term market risk, they cannot hope to accumulate the higher rates of return that will compound and give them the nest egg that they'll need.
Yeah, people of that age need to understand that volatility is actually their friend. While they're accumulating, they need or want bad markets. And bad markets don't feel good, but nevertheless, it's much better to buy a can of tuna when it's on sale than to buy it when it's overpriced because there's strong demand for it, right?
You're absolutely right. I mean, great analogy there. And I got to tell you, I get bummed out when the market goes up. I like it when the market goes down because, as you said, it's things going on sale. It gives me a chance to buy something. I don't want to buy stuff when prices are high. And,
yeah.
And you know, you try to impart that mentality to people, and it's a tough sell. The other one I kind of point out is, in particular, young people. I know I see a lot of them. They'll drive 90 miles an hour down the interstate while tailgating and texting and changing lanes without signaling in the rain, but they're afraid to put their 401k money in the stock market because they think that's risky. You know, at some point, you got to reevaluate the risk in your life.
Yeah.
And over long periods of time, your biggest risk is not the short-term volatility in the markets. Your biggest risk is investing too conservatively and not growing your buying power.
Yeah. Well, you know, Greg, you're obviously a freak if you don't like to see markets go up. I mean, there's something absolutely wrong with you there. But it's actually in the same freakish category as a Warren Buffett.
Yeah, I'll take that.
You know, I put you down and then I brought you back up real quick on that one. My guest is Greg McBride. He is Senior Vice President, Chief Financial Analyst for Bankrate.com. Real estate is interesting because study after study has shown that typical real estate grows only maybe by the rate of inflation. Let's say it's 2 to 3% a year. maybe at the most 5% a year. But the only thing that can make real estate really good is the leverage that you can get when you buy your own home. And a 2 or 3% rise on 100 cents on the dollar, if you've only put 20 cents on the dollar down, can be fairly significant. Actually, I do have some numbers here. For the last 3 years, the real estate market has increased over 9%, but the S&P 500 has increased just under 15%. And so you would think that individual investors would say, you know, look what I'm missing. And the fact that you're telling me that so many people are still in cash is truly an anomaly. I guess the best thing to say would be that let me know when this cash goes into stocks, because that's probably going to be near the top of the market.
You're exactly right. I mean, and so far it is an anomaly, because as we've seen time and time again, as I'm sure you've seen throughout your career, is individual investors tend to chase performance. In other words, when the market's doing really well, people are piling in. We haven't seen people jump on the stock market bandwagon yet. And I say yet, I'm referring like all the way back to 2009. So we're 6 years and counting, and people haven't jumped on the bandwagon. And with each passing day, I just get more concerned, like you, Steve, that at the point where that hesitant, nervous individual investor finally capitulates and gets into the market, then it's going to be just in time for an inevitable pullback, you know, short-term correction. And then what are they going to do? They're going to bail. And so they repeat this cycle of buy high, sell low, which, not to overstate the obvious, is the opposite of what you want to do.
Yeah. You know, there's a phenomenon going on in my practice now. We had quite a number of new people come to us about a year ago or so, and really kind of at the tail end of, looking back, was a pretty good 3 to 5 year run from the crisis. But for the last year, stocks have been flat, and they're going, well, where is my 6 or 7% that you thought I would get? And I have to explain continuously that that's a return over a lifetime. It's not a return that we expect at any given 1 year. And this year, stocks have been more volatile than usual. And if you had a 401k with the S&P 500 fund in it or some similar growth fund, you'd find that maybe some part of the year you were up 4% or maybe even 5%, and then you're down 3%. You're negative for the year, and it just keeps going on and on in this kind of choppy market. And I think that's making people nervous. And, you know, I used to say that people tend to look, you know, when they're driving, it's like looking at the lines going by on the road. They're not looking at the horizon. You always have to keep your focus totally on the horizon. And that is frightening. Hey, Greg, were there any households, demographically speaking, that preferred stocks?
We actually found that those in their 30s actually had a higher preference for stocks, which is reassuring, you know, because they too are going to have a big retirement savings burden. They also have a little bit more seasoning, if you will, in the sense that they've seen some more of those ups and downs in the market and they have a better perspective. So a little bit of reassurance there. Maybe those millennials that today are so risk averse will warm up to it a little bit with some more seasoning, but can't come soon enough.
It wasn't that long ago that gold was hot. Where does gold and precious metals fit into this ranking order?
It falls behind stocks. It's actually a distant fourth, and it's been there for years. We really haven't seen any movement. We've surveyed this question in particular now for 3 consecutive years, and gold has been falling much of those 3 years, and yet the appetite for it has virtually unchanged. Consistently 14%, 16% of Americans cite that as their preferred investment for money that they won't need for the long term. And, you know, the thing about precious metals is you're being able to sell that in the future is solely dependent on the price going up if you're going to make any profit. There's no cash flows from it. There's no dividends. I mean, even in sort of a range-bound market like we have now, which we were talking about a minute ago, you know, I tell people, don't focus so much on what the price is. If you're reinvesting your dividends, look at your share count. Your share count is growing. So the market may not be moving anywhere, but you're still getting a return. You're getting a higher share count that, you know, when the market does start to move higher, now your account balance, now your net worth is going to grow at an exponentially faster rate than what you've seen before.
No, that's a good idea. And finally, what about bonds? Where do bonds fit on this ranking scale?
Now, this is the one area where I think people got it right. Bonds are bringing up the rear. Just 5% of Americans chose that for their preferred long-term investment, which I think is good news. I mean, when interest rates go up, bonds are going to get hammered. And there's a lot of investors that have poured into bonds rather than stocks in recent years, and they've done so under the guise of safety, not realizing that when interest rates go up, bond prices fall. And, you know, with individual bonds, you may be fine because you can hold it to maturity and ride out that volatility. But with a bond mutual fund or a bond ETF, you don't have that luxury. So, you know, this is an area where I'm actually reassured that so few people look to bonds. I mean, not only are you not getting much in the way of income, but you've got some significant price risk on longer-term bonds when interest rates finally move up.
Yeah, but really, when you look at what cash is a one-day bond. It's really a bond in a sense, right? I mean, that's how I view it. You have a money market, they invest in overnight securities. It's an obligation of the issuer. It's a bond. So maybe when you add bonds and you add cash together, maybe the picture isn't quite so rosy. Now, talking about interest rates, for the last 3 years, experts have been predicting that interest rates are going to rise. And actually, they did rise a little bit earlier in the year when I'm looking at the interest rate on the 10-year U.S. Treasury. But now they've come down again, and now there's still talk about the Fed raising very short-term interest rates in the fall. The fact that China has changed the way they're valuing their currency, is that something new entering into the market that's going to affect interest rates, in your opinion?
I don't think in and of itself it will, just because I think the Fed is going to look at that as almost noise, if you will. I think the bigger concern is what happens with the overall Chinese economy. If China ends up having a recession, everybody's going to feel it. And there's no way in the world the Fed is going to be able to raise interest rates in an environment like that. But as it stands, just the minor revaluation of the currency that they've done, I don't think that's enough to deter the Fed from acting. Of course, you know, if we see, you know, contagion, you see a number of other economies undercutting the value of their currencies to keep up. If you see a sharp market pullback like we saw in 1997 when this happened before, you know, then the Fed's game plan could certainly be put on hold.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about Bankrate.com. By the way, my guest is Greg McBride. He is Senior Vice President, Chief Financial Analyst for Bankrate.com. I want to talk about the site. Now, of course, you know, and my listeners should know that I have no financial interest in any of this, but I try to bring the best, most objective advice I can to everyone listening. Let's talk about some of the features on Bankrate.com. There's something called MyBankrate.com you were telling me off air. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this is a new feature we have on Bankrate.com. It's MyBankrate. You can click on it directly from the homepage. What you do is you can sign up here, monitor your credit, get a free copy of your credit report, monitor your credit score, and get tailored offers that come to you, especially for you, for, say, the better deal on credit cards or letting you know when it's a good time to refinance the mortgage. So I would encourage everybody to check that out. That's in addition to all the other great features that we still have in terms of the free search engine to find the very best rates and fees, the editorial content we're updating constantly, as well as the free calculators that really can help you walk you through any financial decision you need to make.
So if you're looking for a loan, let's say a 30-year mortgage, you go to Bankrate.com. You'll see a list of what different competitors are offering, get a sense of the marketplace, choose to give them one of them a call or go back to your lender and say, hey, I can get it better over here, whatever. But at least you have an independent source of getting the kind of information you need. Now, I've been working with some people recently for them to get a home equity line of credit. And the first thing I do when I'm in my office, let's say, and I'm speaking with a client, is just go right up on the screen, Bankrate.com. We can see the whole list. It starts the conversation. It gives the perspective that you need. So you just don't go into your bank and your friendly banker who would love, you know, to give you a home equity line of credit at prime plus 3 or 4% when there's a lot of other offers out there that may be better. So mortgages are good there. I know you guys used to do CDs. I haven't looked at those in a while.
Yeah, we still do. It's just that
nobody wants them.
There's not a whole lot of appeal for a lot of investors simply because the rates are so low. But we've got them. So when the rates improve, by all means, check it out.
What about money funds? That's a big deal. A lot of people are holding a lot of money in their brokerage accounts next to zero. But money, there are some banks and money market institutions that offer fairly decent rates. Tell us about that.
Yeah, sure. I mean, we're in a low rate environment. So I think you got to take things in context. But quite simply, the money that's sitting in your brokerage account in a money fund is earning next to nothing. I mean, you're literally earning 0.02% or something like that, whereas we find online savings accounts, money market deposit accounts offered by a number of banks or credit unions around the country that are paying over 1%, as much as 1.25%. So you're looking at a way to increase your interest earnings, in some cases, 100-fold mm-hmm. over what you're getting. Yes, rates are still low, but that's going to give you the best shot at maintaining your buying power. And when interest rates go up, those are the banks that are going to be on the leading edge of that. We've seen those top-yielding accounts actually increase from a top end of about 0.85% a couple of years ago to 1.25% now, and that's in an environment where the Fed hasn't been raising rates. So when the Fed does start to raise rates, now these are the institutions that are going to be on the cutting edge in terms of boosting that return that you get on your savings, whether it's your emergency savings or money that you're just holding back for a specific near-term need.
You know, Jamie Dimon, the CEO of J.P. Morgan, said in his latest discussion with shareholders that the fungibility of the movement of funds from one institution to another, deposits aren't as sticky as they used to be because, you know, it used to be with the bank, you'd have this relationship, you'd have to kind of move the money over to another bank. But now, since this all can be done electronically, they expect money to move more freely to competitors as interest rates rise. So banking is changing as well there too. And I think that's exactly what you're talking about. Unfortunately, we are out of time. Once again, my guest is Greg McBride. He is Senior Vice President and Chief Financial Analyst for Bankrate.com. Hey, Greg, great to talk to you again.
It's always a pleasure, Steve. Thanks so much for having me.
You're listening to On the Money with Certified Financial Planner Steve Pomerantz. If you'd like information about guests, topics, or anything you hear on this program, call 866-MONEY01 or visit the show's website at onthemoneyradio.org.